Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Reason Podcast special post-debate edition. I'm Austin Bragg of Reason TV, hosting this podcast because I lost a bet. And with me today are Reason luminaries Eric Boehm and Peter Suderman. Guys, how is everybody doing?
Happy Thursday. I'm doing great.
Is it Friday yet? I think it's Friday.
Almost. It's Friday. Let's talk about any standout moments from the debate. What stuck out to you guys, good or bad?
The standout moment and the standout candidate, I think, was Andrew Yang, and in particular, his defense of immigration. Immigration is good. It's, if you have a good country, you want people to come to it. You want them to add to it. You want them to build businesses here. And that's basically what he said. And in general, I thought really Andrew Yang was the standout candidate tonight. I mean, on the one hand, we got to see the big three compete against each other for the first time. We've not had Sanders, Warren, and Biden on the same stage together, but we also saw the second tier candidates competing against those big candidates. And Yang was the one who dominated, I felt like, and whose personality stood out. First of all, he started with a big stunt, which was, I'm going to give 10 families $1,000 a month for a whole year, right? Bought himself 10 votes right up front. Like, he's guaranteed to get those. But also, he just was sort of personable and friendly and interesting, and had actually a lot of interesting stuff to say, including, I mean, so look, his UBI proposal is one that I think libertarians are at minimum split on, but he pitched this as a way for individuals to be able to make their own decisions without government telling them what to do. And so you combine that with his very strong defenses of immigration. You combine that he's the only candidate in previous debates who has mentioned libertarians at all, and it has always been positively when he has done so. He was really somebody who was a fascinating presence, and who was different from everybody else on stage in a way that I thought was notable and important.
And I thought he really differentiated himself today from his previous debate performances, where we've sort of joked in the office about how every one of his answers would always come back to the, oh, and I'm going to give you $1,000 a month idea, which is his one big idea. And it is an idea that nobody else is talking about. So good for him for having something different, whether you agree with it or not. Depends on your opinion of the UBI. But tonight he did expand beyond that, I thought, in a substantial way and in a significant way. On immigration, that was really the best answer. Also, in the response, the section where they were talking about education and schools, he had a good response there, a good sort of substantive response about the importance of having good schools and having not just expecting schools to raise children, but expecting that sort of parents and the life that a child lives outside of the classroom is also just as important. So I think that's important for his candidacy, if it's going to be something more than just a flash in the pan and like, oh, he had a couple interesting debates. He's got to go beyond the UBI thing, which is cool and interesting, but he needs to be bigger than that.
Yeah, and his education answer is also sort of worth picking apart just a little bit. He did, like a lot of Democrats, call for paying teachers more, but then went on to say, look, what happens in school isn't actually the most important determinant of educational outcomes and of outcomes in life. And I think that's something that teachers who are, Democrats who are in many ways kind of enthralled to the teachers unions and who have been captured by the teachers unions could say a lot more about because it's true. And Yang is rare in his willingness to say something that isn't just let's do more for teachers because they're our constituency.
Yang had the shortest amount of time on stage speaking, I think a little under 8 minutes. Do you think he can still fight when he's got to cover 25% of a debate?
That'll be interesting to see. I don't know that he'll be around when the debate stage gets that small. I hope he will be, because I think he brings something interesting and challenging to the debates. He certainly has a different perspective on things than an Elizabeth Warren or a Joe Biden does. So I would love to see him on a smaller stage. I don't know. I don't know that he's got enough policy chops to stick with, especially like an Elizabeth Warren over a 2-hour debate if he couldn't kind of fade into the background at times.
I think he may have the policy chops. I mean, this guy actually has, if you look, he has more on-record plans than Elizabeth Warren. Now, he doesn't always talk about them. They don't get the attention. But he's just got rafts and rafts of policy plans, and he can describe them pretty well at will. What I'm not sure he has is the polling support. And that is just what's going to end up mattering, is that he is somebody who's polling at the low end of the second tier at this point, maybe at the top end of the third tier even. He is somebody who is barely holding on to his slot in the 10-person debate.
Yeah, getting to this debate was an accomplishment for him.
Yeah, so I would not expect him to be around when there are, say, 5 or 6 candidates left. But I'm glad he's here now, and I'm glad he is being different than a lot of the rest of the candidates.
And one last point on that, I think, if I understand the rules for these things correctly, and they're very convoluted, but I believe he's automatically qualified for the next debate because he was in the one tonight. All of these 10 will progress, presuming their candidacies are still, they haven't dropped out of the race, to the next debate next month. And then there may be a few others joining them if they qualify.
Yes.
So he gets at least one more shot at this. And who knows what happens after that, I guess.
Correct. Eric, what else did you see? Standout moment from the debate tonight.
Standout moment. Andrew Yang was definitely making the play for the Libertarian vote, so that was probably that's a good one. I think the other really standout moment was there were several from Joe Biden. I love the Kierkegaard reference that he dropped towards the end. He really faded, I thought, as the debate went on, but in the first hour, he was very strong in the discussion over healthcare. We're going to talk about that at more length here, but in particular, he had an exchange with Bernie Sanders over the cost of Medicare for All, and at one point even saying this is about candor, honesty, big ideas. Let's have a big idea. The tax of 2% that Sanders is talking about raises about $3 billion. Guess what? That leaves you $28 billion short. $28 billion short of the $30 billion proposal that that Senator Sanders has for Medicare for All, and just sort of the fact that we had Democratic candidates talking about math and talking about what a government policy or a government run health insurance program is going to cost, that is kind of novel and different. We haven't seen a lot of that in these debates. We should see more of it. So that stood out to me, and I thought he had pretty strong defenses for Obamacare, which there's good things and plenty of bad things in Obamacare, but certainly Joe Biden standing up for what he accomplished or what the Obama administration accomplished, which he was a part of. And I thought, importantly, pushing back against some of these more socialist, democratic socialist ideas that, hey, the government's just going to pay for all your plans. Bernie Sanders earlier this week had a tweet about how it costs, what, $32,000 to give birth in a hospital on average in America, and how under his plan, it'll cost nothing. And it was just like it
totally
got torn apart.
Disingenuous.
Completely
totally
disingenuous.
Disingenuous or just clueless, one of the two, right? Like, I mean, Sanders was taking the cost of a typical birth, but the average cost, which means the very, very expensive sort of rare case births. And that was the $32,000 figure, was the average of all of birth costs. So not what you would typically pay for a normal birth. And that $32,000 is not the figure that most ordinary people with insurance pay. Most people with insurance pay much, much less than that. And most people with insurance who have a normal birth that isn't some sort of rare circumstance, right, like an that involves a kind of a medical emergency, that cost is typically more like $8,000 or so. And people pay much less of that out of pocket themselves. And then what he was doing is saying that, well, under Medicare for All, it would be totally free. No, it wouldn't be free. It just would be no cost to you at the hospital. Instead, you would be paying for it through your taxes. And so would everybody else. And it would be, so what he's done is basically sort of, eliminate the back end cost of Medicare for All while maximizing the back end cost of the admittedly quite flawed, highly problematic public-private system that we currently have.
And I thought Biden got to the heart of that today. They had, again, as part of this same exchange, Biden was talking about how, you think it's going to be free, but you're actually paying for it in your taxes. And in fact, the taxes that Sanders has put forward are insufficient. You're going to be paying larger taxes. And at the end of this sort of exchange, where Sanders was talking about how, there's going to end up, you're going to see, basically, you're going to pay your premium in your paycheck, was the line that I think it was Sanders had at one point. And Biden ended up kind of boxing him into a corner by asking whether you think workers are going to see that money, whether they're going to see more money in their paychecks up front because they don't have to pay for healthcare out of their paycheck, but they're rather paying it in
taxes. And Sanders was like, well, yeah, of course. Sure.
Right.
And Biden's response was great, which was, for a socialist, you have an awful lot more confidence in big corporations than I do. Yeah, I mean, the healthcare discussion was, you know, in some ways it was kind of repetitive. It was yet another kind of 45-minute opening discussion in which the major candidates in particular squabbled over Medicare for All or some variant on it, with Joe Biden being the anti-Medicare for All guy. He wants to do what's called a public option, which is an additional government run insurance plan that would run alongside private plans inside Obamacare's exchanges, whereas Bernie Sanders wants to effectively eliminate private health insurance, certainly private health insurance as we understand it now, his plan would do it in about 4 years, and then have the government take over virtually all financing of healthcare in the United States. And so it really would be, in a true sense, a government takeover of healthcare. And as part of that, it would move all of the spending on healthcare onto the government's books. And so that means that conservatively, you'd end up in the $30 trillion range. But even Sanders has said, well, it could be $40 trillion. And so, you know, Biden actually had an interesting line where he's like, my plan for the public option and doing a couple of other things, my plan costs a lot of money, he said. It costs $740 billion. And that's over 10 years. And Sanders' plan costs $30 or $40 trillion by Sanders' own estimate. And Sanders has no way to pay for it. He has some pay-fors that he's laid out. They maybe get you not quite halfway to the very rosy estimates for how much his plan is going to cost. And Biden kept pressing him, how would you pay for this? How would you pay for this? What mechanism would you set up to tax people? Because if all of this has to be paid for by the government, then what that means is all of this has to be paid for by tax dollars, which are going to come out of your paycheck, which are going to come out of money that you make, money that somebody here makes.
But according to Sanders, right, universal coverage would cost $30 billion. We're already spending $50 trillion. So why are you taking away my $20 trillion, Peter?
So first of all, there's a couple of problems with this. One is that, look, Sanders wants you to think it's going to cost a lot less with Medicare for All. If that's true, it's because we've paid current Medicare rates for all services. So right now, there are several different payment systems in the United States. Some are private, some are public. But basically, you can divide these two into private insurers pay something like 170% of Medicare rates in a lot of places, whereas Medicare rates are then much lower. And so hospitals and doctors kind of average out the two. If you paid everyone Medicare rates, what would that mean? It would mean that, yes, there were a lot of savings, but where would those savings come from? They would come from the jobs of healthcare workers. And so in some cases, that might be surgeons and specialists who are already getting paid very well. But in a lot of cases, what that's actually going to mean are nurse anesthesiologists and specialized healthcare workers who are not quite doctors. The middle class jobs, especially in rural areas, which is where you see a lot of hospitals that are already struggling to bring in revenue and are already overloaded with Medicare patients and struggling to live on survive on Medicare rates. And so if you cut that money out of the system, then what you're doing is you're cutting payments to workers out of the system. And those people no longer have jobs. And so you lose a lot of jobs. And then the other thing is that you probably end up just losing hospitals themselves, because those rural hospitals that are struggling, they're going to close. And this is something, a point that John Delaney, who was not on stage tonight, but John Delaney, who is a candidate, he's a representative from Maryland, and former healthcare executive, has made this point very frequently, which is he has probably overstated it. He has said, well, look, all the hospitals, you know, you'd just have all these hospitals that would close. You would actually have a lot of them that would probably find some way to stay open, but you would probably see some hospital closures. And in fact, we are seeing all around the country right now, even before Medicare for All, we are seeing some hospitals struggle to stay open simply because they have a patient caseload that is too heavy on Medicare and thus too dependent on Medicare's low rates.
There are a lot of big numbers in this debate. I don't want to just totally jump away from the very important point Peter was just making, but we both screwed up earlier the trillion billion point, and that's I was looking at that on the Washington Post's transcript of this debate. I don't know whether Biden said billion when he meant trillion or whether the Post. My point in all of this is that I wonder how much of this healthcare debate really locks in with voters. Like, how much are voters paying attention to the details of what Warren or Sanders is saying versus the details of what Biden is saying? You, Peter Suderman, are obviously paying close attention. I am paying relatively close attention, not to the level that you are. But I wonder how many people out there are really grasping the details or even attempting to, because at the end of the day, whatever the winner, you know, and this assumes that a Democrat wins in 2020, which is maybe a big assumption to make in the first place. But whatever healthcare plan ends up being in front of Congress in 2021 or sometime in the future is going to be sort of altered by the outcome of the general election. It's going to be you know, affected by whoever's in Congress. There's going to be we are a long way from a final program of a President Biden or President Sanders. Why does all this minutia matter at this early stage? Why do we spend 30 minutes in every debate talking about it? I don't want to make it sound like it's not important, but I do kind of wonder why this ends up being the top issue every time.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it doesn't matter. In some ways, you're totally right, which is that the president doesn't write healthcare legislation. Congress does. And in fact, there was a kind of fascinating interview with four top Senate Democrats by Ezra Klein at Vox.com recently, in which they all said, well, you know, this whole single payer thing, we're not really in favor of that. We pretty much want to do a strong public option, which is pretty much Joe Biden's plan. It's not exactly, but it's very close to what Joe Biden was saying. And if Congress is writing the legislation and Congress has to vote on it, then it doesn't matter if President Sanders wants Medicare for all and wants a big full-fledged single payer bill, because Congress isn't going to get there. And I think that's a big obstacle for Medicare for all that Sanders just isn't dealing with at all. On the other hand, it does matter because Democratic voters care about this. And you consistently find that polls of Democratic voters, they say that healthcare is the number one issue. And you go back and you look at the results from the 2018 election, the exit polls show where Democrats retook the House. The exit polls show that healthcare was the number one issue for voters. And that's not just Democratic voters. That is just voters, period. Voters care an awful lot about healthcare. And so while these debates have gotten a little bit repetitive, and I saw people complaining, oh, we've seen this opening 40-minute segment before, they've been making, you know, these same arguments this whole time. And I don't think that's quite true. This was a better and more substantive version of it, which is not surprising given that they've now done this three times. Because Democratic voters care so much, and because most of them are not tuning in to every single debate like we are, it is a thing that is relevant, and it's useful to understand not only where candidates are on the issue, but how they think in relation to their opponents, and to see what, say, Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or even Kamala Harris will say when confronted with some of these, the arguments made by their opponents. And in fact, I think Kamala Harris, who did okay tonight, who did in some ways better than she has than she did in the last debate, Kamala Harris had a pretty bad summer after having a pretty good spring and early part of the year, and a big reason why was because she stumbled on healthcare and she couldn't really explain what her plan was. Tonight she tried to explain it, and her plan was Donald Trump is bad. But seeing her stumble and seeing her being unable to talk through her own plan was useful information to voters. It has been now accounted for in the polls, and that's why we are seeing these debates.
Totally agree that the high level sort of takeaway is really more important than the lower level details of the plan, except maybe the flip side of that, and I'm going to contradict what I just said about voters maybe not caring about the minutiae here, is there was another exchange that stood out to me on healthcare, and this one was between Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren over how many people would lose their health insurance under a plan that Senator Warren has put forth, and Klobuchar kind of pushed back on this.
So Warren doesn't have a health care plan of her own. She has.
Sorry, this was a bill that Warren
kind
had previously
of
proposed.
Endorsed the Bernie plan.
Sure.
She has endorsed the Bernie plan, but she has not said this is she's come close to saying this is my plan. She said I'm with Bernie, but she's done this weird thing where it's like it's not her plan.
The big number here is 149 million people. George Stephanopoulos at one point just said 149 people, in which case I guess we could just forget those guys. 149 million
Andrew
people.
Andrew Yang is going to provide health insurance.
He'll do it by
$100,000
a month.
By lottery.
Yeah, we'll just decide who gets it. The 149 million people could stand to lose their health insurance. And again, this seems to me like we're probably paying less attention to that number than to some of these other numbers. But I think that's a number that to many voters is probably more significant, right? We remember the big outcry over the Obama's promise that if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor, and how that turned out to not be true for what was it? It was dozens of millions of people, not 150 million.
So depending on the numbers, it's anywhere from 1.5 million to 5 or 6 million. So it wasn't quite in
this
a double digit.
10 times,
but it was
that,
millions
that
of
here,
it was
right.
It was certainly millions of people could not keep their existing plans under Obamacare, and the administration went through some illegal stuff to grandfather in some of those plans, which reduced the number of people who lost plans that they had. On the other hand, it meant that you had the Obama administration taking illegal actions in order to try to defend a promise that Obama made knowing that it was bunk.
My point is that I wonder if, I mean, we're talking 10 times as many people potentially who could lose their health insurance. It's different, I think, if you say it up front, would lose their health
under
insurance.
Under the Sanders plan, private insurance as we know it would be illegal. It does not allow for insurance that competes with the government plan. So that means typical comprehensive insurance that gets you into the doctor, that would be illegal. And so the plan you have, the plan that hundreds of millions of people in the United States have from their employers, the Obamacare plans, all of those comprehensive private health insurance plans would no longer exist. Now, Sanders would say, that's true, but that's because you'd have much better coverage under Medicare for All. But the point is that there would be a huge transition cost and a huge amount of disruption. And the disruption, even if you say, okay, there's going to be insurance on the other side of this disruption, what happened when Obamacare went online in 2013? The system didn't work. And we're going to trust the government?
Yeah.
The system didn't work. And the only reason that they got it back up and running was basically because Obama broke the regulatory rules that were in place for how these systems get managed. And so, that's what's going to there is a similar sort of a disruption in store for Medicare for All, except on a much grander scale.
And Warren made this point tonight, and I know we need to move on to talk about other things, but Warren made this point explicitly tonight where she said nobody likes their health insurance anyway. It doesn't, right? I don't know anybody. People like their doctors. People like their nurses. Nobody likes their health insurance agent.
Which is not true.
Well, it may or may not be true, but it's going to be a huge disruption. It's a big number. I'm surprised that doesn't get talked about more. I think Amy Klobuchar has not done much to stand out in this race and didn't do a whole lot tonight, but she did bring up that number tonight, and I would look for that number to be talked about maybe more in the future, because I think that's a number that's half of America, or almost half of America, and that's something that the Democrats are going to have to talk about more either now, or they will be forced to talk about it later.
Well, since we're talking about market distortions, another big topic of the evening was trade. Everyone talking about how they would deal with China, whether you want to bring labor unions and environmentalists to the table for trade negotiations. That was up for debate tonight. What do you guys think?
I think the Democrats are generally pretty bad on trade, and that continued tonight. Although, again, hey, no surprise, I sort of liked some of what Andrew Yang had to say about trade. I don't think he was as strong on trade as he was on education or on immigration. He didn't say that he would repeal the tariffs on day one, but he did say that he would let the Chinese know that we need to hammer out a deal. I don't know how that's a whole lot different than Trump's approach, right? It doesn't seem like he really grasps it either, but at least that was better than some of what the other candidates said. Elizabeth Warren's trade policy, which she talked about a little bit tonight, and she has a long trade policy paper out on the internet. That is all. It's very bad. It would make it very difficult for the United States to sign trade deals with basically any developing country anywhere in the world. which is not only a problem for the United States, but it's a problem for those developing countries that she says she wants to, well, she wants to put American workers first, but presumably she also wants to help other people around the world too, and that wouldn't help anybody. It wouldn't help American workers, and it certainly, the fact that we trade with other countries is what in many cases helps them develop better labor standards and better environmental standards over time. There are many problems with her approach on trade, and I was really disappointed. I mean,
her approach to trade is functionally, it's maybe not exactly the same as Donald Trump's, but it's very similar in a lot of ways, which is why folks like Tucker Carlson, who really like Donald Trump's approach to trade, have praised Elizabeth Warren's plan for what she calls economic patriotism.
Yeah,
and it's industrial policy. It's just industrial policy, and it's just a kind of tariffs first way of managing the economy through through trade.
It's basically her pitch on trade more or less boils down to that she would be a more competent protectionist than Trump has been, which is probably true. I mean, I have no reason to doubt that that is true. That is exactly what she would be. And in some ways, she would be worse than Trump because I think she would actually be effective and competent at doing these things, whereas, his trade war has been marked by this sort of haphazard slapdash approach. She would be not haphazard. There's nothing about Elizabeth Warren that is haphazard or slapdash. So she would get these things done. The sort of lack of uncertainty that she would bring may be in some ways better than what Trump has done. But that's at that point kind of coming out in the wash. I would mention Buttigieg's response on trade kind of confused me a little bit because I had heard him speak at the Washington Post. This was in May, right around Memorial Day weekend, maybe. And I was really impressed by him, but I was particularly impressed. And I wrote a piece at the time about his response on trade, and I thought it was pretty strong. And tonight he seemed to almost take maybe a half step, maybe a three quarter step back from that. He said he sort of reiterated what Yang had said about not removing the tariffs on day one, using them as leverage against China. The Democrats in general, there seems to be this general consensus of protectionism is maybe good and maybe we should try it. And we want to make a play for the upper Midwest in the general election. So we're going to talk about these issues that matter to Rust Belt blue collar voters. That's all fine and good, maybe as a political strategy. It's not a good economic strategy. It's not a good industrial policy. And that's going to be something that they're going to have to deal with. And I think it's really interesting when you look at polling numbers to see the way Democrats have shifted towards free trade. And these types of things, there are not many voters that are single issue free trade voters. So you do kind of have to filter that when you look at these trade issues in polls. If a Republican is doing things a certain way on trade, Democratic voters are likely to say, I want the opposite to happen. So, there is kind of this constant ebb and flow on trade when this gets polled. But Democratic voters in the latest Pew and Gallup polls have been far more supportive of free trade as a concept and of eliminating tariffs under Trump than they have been for the last, several decades, honestly. So it's interesting to see that these presidential candidates don't really seem to be in step with the voters that they are trying to appeal to. And they're trying to temper some of the protectionism, but they're also clearly not going as strongly against Trump on some of these things as they could.
Yeah, Buttigieg's response was really quite disappointing. I mean, he starts by saying, well, Donald Trump has no strategy with his tariffs, which, fair enough. Like, I think that's a completely fair criticism of the president. And then the moderator asks a totally reasonable follow-up. Okay, so Donald Trump has no strategy. What's your strategy? And Buttigieg's response boiled down to, I would have a strategy. And that's not one. And he even kind of, said, well, look, I might even keep the tariffs as negotiating tools, right? Sort of as I'd leave them on the table, right? He didn't quite commit to sort of leaving them in place, but maybe at least leaving the threat of them in place. And it really did seem like a kind of a pander to like a very narrow swath of voters that they're trying to flip from Donald Trump, probably in the West, in the Rust Belt, in places like where Buttigieg comes from.
And just to defend Buttigieg, his response was not good. I'm not impressed at all with what he said tonight. But he's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, which is first of all in the Rust Belt, and second of all, he's the mayor of a small town. Like, he's never probably had to think about international trade policy before. It's understandable if he's a step or two behind on some of this, and that's why this is really far afield. But it's really kind of a shame that a guy like Pete Buttigieg is running for president. president because in a normal political environment, he would be running for a different office. He would be working his way up and he would be a presidential candidate in a decade or so and probably a pretty good one. And that just says something about kind of where we're at as a country in terms of people jumping straight to the presidency instead of putting their talents to work in other places.
Mayor Pete for governor.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe. I mean, 100%.
Maybe. I don't know.
But, you know, that's what he should be going for.
No, of the Democrats, I would vote for Mayor Pete for governor first. I'm not sure he would actually be a
governor. But you would have to live in Indiana,
governor.
Peter. Would that's you live true. In Indiana? Yeah.
I don't.
Probably not. Yeah.
Live in Indiana, I think, is the actual answer to that question.
Who did we miss tonight? What did we miss tonight? What didn't we hear aside from Marianne Williamson?
Oh man, I missed Marianne Williamson personally, though probably the debate was a little more on point without her on stage, maybe a little less fun. I missed Tulsi Gabbard, and her presence was especially her lack of presence was especially glaring in the foreign policy section, where she has been the most consistent anti-war voice and has made that the focus of her campaign in a way that no other candidate has, and that I think is important, and especially given how reflexively hawkish most Republicans, in some ways Donald Trump accepted, but especially given how reflexively hawkish most Democrats are, given how reflexively hawkish most Republicans are, it's important to have somebody like Tulsi Gabbard on stage in the Democratic field.
Although we did get sort of the spirit of Tulsi Gabbard at one point in Lindsey Davis's question to Kamala Harris about her record while she was attorney general in California, which was more, I mean, it wasn't quite word for word, but it was very similar to the attack that Gabbard launched on Harris, I thought, very effectively at the last debate. So for a moment, I felt like Tulsi is with us in spirit. The thing that I missed tonight was, aside from the one thing that we talked about earlier, which was Biden kind of doing a little bit of calculating on Bernie Sanders' healthcare plan, there was really no talk about math beyond that. There was no talk about the budget or the budget deficit or the national debt, which is quickly approaching $23 trillion, and which most of these candidates have plans that in one form or another would add trillions more to that. So there was really no discussion of exactly how you're going to pay for any of these things, or what, even if you're not going to talk about how you're going to pay for new things, how are we going to constrain government or raise taxes or do whatever needs to be done just to kind of bring the existing size and scope of the federal government into balance? There was absolutely nothing on that once again.
And no talk about the state of the economy, which used to be a major talking point, discussion point for presidential debates. But the economy is doing well. And so it's not, in some ways, you know, it's fair that they're not talking about it because it's not a problem for the president to solve. And yet, Elizabeth Warren's campaign is predicated in large part on the idea that actually, secretly, the economy is rotten to its core. And look, the economy, by the time this podcast comes out, it's possible the economy will be in recession. No, that's not quite right. But I mean, but certainly by the time we have voting in Iowa, by the time there is a general election next year, there is a real risk. There are some very, very clear warning signs, in particular, coming from because of Trump's trade war, which is really threatening to destabilize the economy. But when Elizabeth Warren argues that the economy is unstable and then says, well, basically, I'm going to continue Trump's trade policy, except more seriously and more competently, that's not a good answer.
She's the only one who can fix it, Peter, don't you see?
She has a plan for that.
All right. Any final thoughts about tonight's debate?
They finished early. That was great. I had my first White Claw hard seltzer of the summer, first one ever.
And you just admitted that in public.
You just got to experience that with me here. And it's not as bad as I thought it would be, although I don't think I'll be drinking another one anytime soon.
I think that's a good review of Democratic debates, maybe.
All right. Well, that's going to do it here for the Reason Podcast. Thank you for listening.